What's up, baddie bees? I'm Brianna, mom, wife, serial entrepreneur, and host of the Badass Basic Bitch podcast. Each week, I sit down with a seemingly ordinary woman who's doing extraordinary things, and I get to share her story with you. So let's go. Buckle up as we're going to get real and dive into the shit nobody talks about. Welcome to the Baddie Bee Club.
You're more likely to fall in love with someone that you have sex with regularly. And love is literally an evolved commitment device. It's literally a physiological addiction designed to get you to bond with someone so that you become attached to them, so that you make a child, and then you bond to that child, and you have a familial bonds, and then you have social bonds. And these bonds are literally designed to keep you alive because you're more likely to share information and resources with those that you trust and love.
Welcome back to another episode of Badass Basic Bitch. On today's episode, we have Dr. Molly Maloof, who is a physician, entrepreneur, and author of The Spark Factor. And today, we are going to be talking about all the complexities of optimizing women's health, from biohacking and hormonal balance to stress management. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Before we get started, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
Okay, so my name is Dr. Molly, and I have three businesses. One of them is my personal brand, and I'm a spokesperson of the company MitoQ. I promote products and services around metabolic health and health optimization, and I do content on Instagram. And then I also have a medical practice, and I'm a concierge medical doctor to all sorts of individuals. Used to be mostly investors, executives, and entrepreneurs. And then I worked with some Academy Award winners in LA. And now I work with all sorts of people digitally in California. And now I'm moved to Jackson, Wyoming. So building a practice here. And then that practice is really around health optimization and metabolic health and health span extension. So how do you extend the number of healthy years of life? And then lastly, I am the founder of the company Adamo. And it is a company developing products and services around the science of human love, with our first product being a therapy around human intimacy. And it's addressing problems that occur during sexuality, romantic relationships, attachment, and it's really a modern day sex therapy. And it hasn't been reinvented since Masters and Johnson in the 60s. So I really try to build my work is really around the first principles of health. And like, what's underneath, how do you optimize health? And really my belief is that if you get your energy right, which through your metabolism, if you get your connection right, and you have a sense of purpose somewhere to direct that energy and that connection, then you thrive and you flourish. And I've been doing this for the last decade. I used to teach at Stanford for a few years. And then I wrote a book called The Spark Factor. So I'm like a living, breathing example of like, when you optimize health and human relationships, like you uncover all sorts of human capacities that you didn't even know you had. And that's me.
I really like that because I think anyone who knows me, work, personal life, whatever, says I am the queen of optimization. However, I've never heard of health optimization and I definitely don't do that. So I would love for you to take us a little bit more deeper into like, what does health optimization look like and what is it?
Yeah. So health optimization, in my opinion, is basically the measuring and improvement of health through qualitative and quantitative assessments. So when I was in medical school, I learned how to evaluate disease and you learn how to take a medical history and you scan a person for disease states and then you test with labs. So I said to myself when I was starting my practice, what if you could take that model and apply it to optimizing health? Because I was on a mission to figure out how do you measure health? How do you improve it? The beauty of my career is it actually led me to finding some answers. So I was one of the first doctors to put blood sugar monitors on healthy people. I was one of the first doctors to be using Oura Rings and wearable technology in Silicon Valley to track a person's exercise, sleep, stress, circadian rhythms. I was obsessed with measurement and monitoring. And then when I was teaching at Stanford, well, I guess before I go into that, so in my practice, I measure gut health, I measure immune system markers, I measure hormones, I measure metabolic markers, chemistry markers, you name it, I measure it. And then I systematically work to optimize each system. So it's a combination of functional medicine, integrated medicine, even some Chinese medicine, naturopathic medicine, and allopathic medicine. And I'm not an osteopath, so I do send people to osteopathic medical doctors if I need them to address that. But basically, I'm a very holistic doctor, but I have a very empirical approach to health optimization, where you take measurements and then you improve things that need to be fixed. Then there's the thing that blew me away in teaching at Stanford. I was building a course on health span and I was teaching these students, and I got to this lecture on human relationships. And I was like, oh my God, literally the greatest factor in longevity and happiness is high quality, healthy personal relationships. And the loneliness, which can be with or without people, so subjective or objective loneliness, with whether you're around people or not, if you feel lonely, it's worse for your health than smoking, drinking, sedentary behavior, and obesity. So when I realized the importance of social connection and personally experienced like real health problems after being in a toxic relationship, I was like, we are completely overlooking the role of human relationships and human connection and health. So I got obsessed with it. And I started studying the science of love, and I built my company Adamo because I was like, we need to start really looking at human love as a science, not just as this wishy-washy concept of an emotion that we sing songs about and write, you know, papers about and, you know, read, you know, like see art about, but like, what is love and why does it matter for longevity? And it basically what my conclusion was is that the greater, so when you have sex with people, you're more likely to fall in love with someone that you have sex with regularly. And love is literally a evolved commitment device. It's literally a physiological addiction designed to get you to bond with someone so that you become attached to them, so that you make a child and then you bond to that child and you have a familial bonds and then you have social bonds. And these bonds are literally designed to keep you alive because you're more likely to share information and resources with those that you trust and love. And so that will get you like that. That is like part of the reason why we evolved all of this. And it sounds a little bit cut and dry and scientific, but if you really think about it, it's part of why it should be emphasized. And also if you're in an unhealthy relationship, you can lose money, you can lose resources, you can lose your health. And I just think we totally overlook the big picture in health. And so I got into health from just like a perspective of like, let's build a real science of health. Let's not just look at this as this hand wavy wellness industry, but let's actually understand why we need to be healthy and why, you know, if we have an unhealthy environment, you know, whether it be our, you know, toxic burden in the environment or the toxic people around us, why does that matter to our health? And why does that affect our longevity?
The whole science of love part that you just referenced is like blowing my mind because I never think of it that way. And I'm very data-driven. I really am. My whole business, my whole everything is just data-driven for me. And so I'm like, as soon as you're saying that, it's so relatable and it makes a lot of sense. It also makes a lot of sense, the correlation and connection to like human nature and our survival. Like it makes sense. Before we go into that, because I feel like I'm going to open up a whole door if I start asking questions for that, I want to go back to the health optimization because I have a question, more of a clarifying question or an example. So you had mentioned putting glucose monitoring systems on healthy folks, right? Whoever is you identify as healthy. Is an example of that, of like health optimization, for example, I had a glucose monitor on, and when I would eat rice, as an example, it would spike my levels up really high and take a long time to drop it, versus even if I just ate ice cream, as an example, like I never spiked if I ate ice cream. Are you trying to optimize of like, these are the things that your body takes a longer time to process and bring you back into regulate? And so we're going to optimize you by focusing on the things that don't spike you or that you can come down on. Is that like what you're talking about? Is that an example?
Yeah.
Okay. So cool.
So I started putting blood sugar monitors on people in 2014, including myself. I was borderline pre-diabetic. I only found this out when I was presenting my data to a quantified self group. And someone says, hey, have you noticed your fasting glucose is like right around 100? And I was like, I didn't even know. Cause like nobody had been really investigating blood sugar monitoring on healthy people. And so I became obsessed, and I'm 40 now. I feel younger and fitter and healthier at 40 than I did at 30. And I think it's because I was actually pretty insulin resistant for a lot of my early 30s. And so I had all sorts of problems. I had hormonal acne. I had mood swings. I had brain problems. Like, fixing my blood sugar fixed so many problems in my life. And I was like, why? Why did this work? You know, like, what was underneath this? And then I started digging into metabolic health. And I realized that, like, a huge driver of metabolic illness is fundamentally, like, our blood sugar,
yes,
right? Like, mm-hmm, people realize that insulin resistance is worse for your, it's basically setting you up for cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and dementia. And I have a family history of Alzheimer's and cancer. And so I'm like thinking about, oh my God, I don't want to get this. And it was really putting these blood sugar monitors on myself and looking at my diet and asking myself, what's really working for me? What doesn't work or working for me? And so here's the interesting stuff that I've found. And it's been a decade of analysis. So, like, I feel like I'm still a few years ahead of most people. And most people fall into two dogmatic camps around blood sugar. There's the people say, go vegan, go low fat, go high carb, eat all the plants, eat all the vegetables. You can eat as many carbs as you want, just don't eat the fat. And they're like, fat causes insulin resistance. Fat causes, and that's what they say, right? Then there's the other side that says, go low carb, lower your glycemic input, make sure you just go low carb and keto, paleo, whatever, just go low carb, fix your problem. So one side is like ramping down the fat. And in certain cases, like my situation, it does help for me not to eat saturated fat. I'm an ApoE4 carrier. Too much saturated fat will contribute to some more insulin resistance in some people. But the problem people don't also realize is that when you go low carb, you are also creating physiological insulin resistance. So a lot of people who eat low carb may have a lower glycemic load. They may have lower insulin output, but they're also setting their body up for, you can't eat any carbs like at ever. All because the moment you touch a carb, even look at a carb, you start to spike. So what I found is that being vegetarian for 4 months, what I learned being vegetarian was I didn't die. I could eat legumes and grains without dying. I thought I was going to like definitely die because I'm celiac and I have some autoimmune issues, but I thought I'm definitely not going to be able to tolerate a vegetarian diet. And turns out I lost like 10 pounds. I lost a lot of hair because I wasn't eating any protein. But when I looked at my blood sugar monitor, the same things that would spike me on a low carb diet were still spiking me on a vegetarian diet, namely flour, sugar, sugar sweetened beverages, and large amounts of white carbs, like large amounts of potatoes, large amounts of rice, white rice, pasta. All these things that I still had problems with when I was even eating paleo and low carb, they were still an issue. So I was like, okay, maybe we need to get outside of the band camps of like, you have to choose. And maybe what we're all need to actually focus on together is like, let's look at the big picture here. And the big picture is you gotta eat whole foods. You have to eat copious amounts of whole foods, right? Like, you need whole foods. Get off the processed foods, get off the refined sugars, get off of the sugar sweetened beverages, get off of the white carbs. And generally speaking, you're going to see an improvement of your insulin sensitivity. But it's not just about your diet. It's also how you move your body. It's also what are your sources of stress? When I was under enormous stress, there was nothing that I could do to fix my blood sugar. It was glycemically variable every day. So that's when I was like, you can't just fix your insulin resistance with diet. You have to look at your relationships. You have to look at your work. You have to look at your circadian rhythms. You have to look at, you know, like how you interact with your environment, right? Your toxic burden can contribute to insulin resistance. So sometimes you need to do a detox. And then you also have to look at hydration. You have to look at light exposure. And the last thing I would say is, I guess what else am I missing? Hormones, right? Like there's a lot of things feed into this. It's not just your diet. And so that's where I see everybody wrong in this pre-diabetes space, in the diabetes space. They're always looking only at food, but it's not just about food. Insulin resistance is a symptom, the body failing to adapt to the stressful allostatic load or the cumulative stress load on the body. So the demands of the body are so high that you start to break at a cellular level. And your mitochondria are not just responsible for metabolizing food. They are responsible for integrating the stress response and the immune system. You can't really isolate, blood sugar problems as just nutritional. And that's the thing that I think is missing from this movement around metabolic health. It's like everybody's focused on the food problem and it's not just food.
Yeah. It's a wide range. It's a whole wheel. I'm really curious because typically people don't make changes or even question the way that they live their lives until there's a reason to, until they hear they're pre-diabetic, until they hear they have an autoimmune, until they hear they're at high risk for cancer, et cetera. So for people listening that are like, you want to spark their curiosity of these things because they don't find it relatable, what are ways that they can start to measure and start to consider like health optimization?
You can go to your doctor and you can get a blood lipid panel. You can get hemoglobin A1C. You can get a fasting insulin. You can get a fasting glucose or a CMP. You can look at your liver function through your AST and ALT. You can look at, if you want to even get a GGT, you can get that too. You can look at your blood sugar metabolism through your fasting insulin, which I want below 6 for people. And I have seen people have normal blood sugar monitors, normal hemoglobin A1C, normal fasting glucose, but their insulin levels are like 16. That's insulin resistance in my book, until proven otherwise. I want to see it low. And then you can look at if you really could get your what's called an NMR lipoprotein profile and an ApoB, that will tell me, do you have lipid metabolism issues? Do you have high cholesterol that can be evaluated properly? Most doctors are just getting total cholesterol, LDL, HDL, and triglycerides, which is not enough, but it does give you a lot of information. Triglycerides tells you, do you have problems with carb metabolism and fat metabolism? Are you maybe on the way to getting metabolic syndrome? Getting your blood pressure checked. Everybody should get that checked. If you have a high waist circumference, high fasting glucose, high triglycerides, you're basically, until proven otherwise, metabolically ill. So there's a lot of things you can do early. But the thing that I want to tell the women out there listening and the men is you can actually reverse the visible appearance of aging by getting your metabolism properly tuned. So you can lose puffiness in your face, wrinkles in your face, acne. You will literally create more light coming out of your skin. Your hair will grow more beautifully. Like, I don't have any gray and I'm 40. And that's because my mitochondria are so healthy. So your hair, when it turns gray, it's peroxide. Your cells are making too much oxidative stress. So you're producing too much peroxide as a byproduct that literally bleaches your hair. So there are people who've literally reversed graying because they fixed their metabolic health. So there's actually so many reasons to do this, let alone wanting to live long for your kids and your grandkids, wanting to not get these diseases of aging, wanting to look great and feel amazing as you get older. It's like a quality of life thing. I have more energy. I have more vitality. I have more I don't have the same problems that I had. I used to have brain fog all the time. I mean, it's crazy to have turned 40 and feel so young and vital and to know that a decade ago, I felt like crap every day, So it's just, to me, it's like, how do you want to feel when you wake up in the morning? Do you want to have energy? Do you want to have enough energy to meet your needs? Well, you got to deal with your metabolism because that's what produces your energy.
And that's where you're saying it's not just a nutritional thing. It's everything combined. And is there a way to do any kind of tests in terms of gut health, or did you name them before?
Yeah. So there's a company called Vitract, V-I-T-R-A-C-T. And it's one of the first consumer companies that I can recommend that I'm telling you is as good as any clinical gut test you can get from a functional doctor. And it is awesome. I mean, you can see everything in this test. Now you might need a functional doctor to interpret it, but I can see if a person needs enzymes. I can see if they need probiotics. I can see if they have SIBO. I can see so many things. I can see if they have pathogenic bacteria growing and they need to do a gut cleanse. I can see if they need, I can see anything in this test. So it's a phenomenal test that you can start with. I'm probably going to end up building a pre-diabetes program in the next year for the masses, because I just feel like everybody's got pre-diabetes these days. 1 in 3 people. And they don't, they're like, okay, cool. What about, what do I do with this? Why does this matter? So I built this entire course, and this course I built is like for Stanford students, which are highly educated, very brilliant kids. And I'm building like a derivative product that's for just the general public. And it's like, what do I need to do to fix my health and live as long as possible? And it's really geared around fixing prediabetes, because one in three people have it. And if I can get it, anybody can. And I see it all the time in my population of people. And I'm just like, people are like, whatever, it's not diabetes yet. Well, guess what? If you end up getting diabetes, if you have prediabetes, you've lost somewhere around 30% of your beta cell function, which I think you can get it back. But if you have diabetes, you lost half of your beta cell function, which means your pancreas is only, it's like the functional reserve is 50% less. Like, you know, if you literally are like, your pancreas is working at 50% capacity. That's scary, because that means that, like, as you get older, it's going to get worse. And as it gets worse, you can end up with dementia. Yeah. You can end up with heart disease, end up with cancer. I had a woman who was a friend of mine. I'm seeing so much breast cancer in young women. And one of my friends had breast cancer, and I showed her when she was eating oatmeal, hey girl, you're getting a spike to 200. Wow. You can't have oatmeal. And she's like, what do you mean I can't have oatmeal with bananas and honey? I'm like, do you see what's going on here? This is not okay. Your pancreas is on overdrive. These are all healthy foods, right? So it's really, I mean, it's, and in her case, she lived in big cities her entire life. So she had a pretty significant toxic burden. So you do, I mean, like, I'm about to do a detox in about a month after I do a month of travel. I'm going to do like a 2-week detox. My friends have a company called the Detox Dudes. If you live in a city or you travel a lot, you're being exposed to so many toxic byproducts that gets into your body and it disrupts metabolism. These heavy metals, these toxic byproducts, they disrupt hormones, they disrupt metabolism. And pretty much what I found is that if you look at almost every program for thyroid health, for hormone health, for autoimmunity, for metabolic health, it's all the same stuff. It's, you got to detox occasionally, you got to eat the right diet for your body. You have to watch your stress. You have to get your sleep and light cycles right. You have to get your movement in. And why is this? Why? And then relationships, right? But why do these same drivers matter to all these different diseases? Because they're all affecting mitochondria. And your mitochondria are like the general contractors of the cell. They're literally like determining, where does the energy go? How do I make energy? And then where does it go? So if your mitochondria aren't functioning properly, it doesn't matter what your genes are, because things are not going to get properly expressed without enough energy. So it's kind of like thinking about a house in a hurricane. You can't do upgrades to a house that's in a storm, right? So if you mess up the function of the energy going to a home, like your body, like, nothing's going to work. So I'm just, my personal practice is like, get to the root cause. And I think a lot of the root causes, you know, let alone, by the way, in intracellular infections. So before the pandemic, I was studying chronic fatigue syndrome. And there's a lot of people listening to this probably have issues with chronic COVID. And I was studying chronic fatigue because I was seeing all these people with CFS. And I was like, I don't believe that this is a hypochondriasis. Like, these people are clearly ill. So I started reading this book called by Amy Myhill. And it was like, Amy Myhill, this doctor in England, she wrote a book called Chronic Fatigue Syndrome. It's mitochondria, not hypochondria. And the point of the book is that if you get an infection that gets inside the cell, so Lyme's disease, COVID, viruses, mycoplasmas, you can basically, these viruses and these bacteria, they can basically hijack your body to produce their own energy. So like, they will literally get in the cell, they'll hijack your metabolic machinery, and they'll use you to make themselves. And this is pretty much like microbiology 101 for medical school. And yet so many doctors lose this when they go into practice. And so if you hijack the metabolic machinery, your energy levels are going to go down. So this is why you see really bad fatigue in people who have really bad infections. So one of the biggest things that's been a breakthrough in the modern movement around optimizing health is what's called EBO2. And I've done this before. I also did what's called apheresis. And basically what it is blood filtration. They take your blood out. In EBO2, they run it through an ozone machine and a dialysis filter. And sometimes if you're lucky, you can get this company that will run it through different light spectrums. And you're essentially getting like a full blood cleanse. And I can tell you from just personal experience that, first of all, apheresis is really expensive. Yes, but what they're doing is they're pulling. They're pulling your blood out. Well, I had been, I had gotten some autoimmune markers back last year that were like not full blown autoimmunity, but like Cyrex Labs testing that said, hey, you're on your way to getting autoimmunity. If you don't nip this in the bud now, you're screwed. So I went hardcore into like bio optimization for 2 months and all of the lab markers resolved. But one of the secrets was I worked with this incredible biohacker, Katrine Valinsky, and she pumped me up with NAD therapy, peptide therapy. And then also I did EBO2 and I did apheresis. And then a few months later I did EBO2 after I had a really bad cold that lasted for like 10 days. And, I've just found that like, if you can really nip things in the bud quickly, it's kind of worth the investment. And so I did apheresis first. And like what apheresis is doing is taking all of your blood out and then taking all of the plasma out and then putting, albumin back in. So they're taking all of the immune markers that are currently in your blood and they're just like filtering them out in one go. It's too expensive for most people to do, but EBO2 is pretty affordable. And I think I got probably the same benefits from EBO2 that I did from apheresis. So I wouldn't really recommend apheresis because it's really expensive, but definitely feel like this is a new frontier that a lot of mainstream doctors are just not looking at it. But it's like, it is a phenomenally effective way to deal with intracellular infections. And then, you know, like if you can basically get all this stuff managed, there's also like the whole regenerative medicine world, right? Where I don't do too much work in peptides, but there are certain peptides that are pretty darn safe, like BPC-157. It's great for gut healing, great for injury recovery. And then there's a few others that like, if someone's got a muscle tear or like a tendon tear or something, thymosin beta 500, things like that.
Man, I feel like this is just extremely educational. I'm gonna make sure I take all the transcript and then summarize it for everyone. Cause I'm going to take that VitaTrack gut stuff because I feel like for me, I always questioned my gut health, you know, and then I'm like, well, I have a lot of issues, but I also have food allergies. So it's hard for me to know, but I'm like, man, if someone could just tell me gut health in that capacity, it would just make me feel better.
Well, food allergies. Okay. So as somebody who has dealt with her own food allergies and is now eating dairy, now I still can't do milk, but I'm eating dairy again. I'm eating lentils again. I'm eating grains again. I had really struggled with these. One of the best things you can do to fix food allergies is to heal your gut. And to me, food allergies are a symptom of gut dysfunction. They are not necessary. Like if you have gut dysfunction and you have leaky gut, you've got these tight junctions that are opened and then food particles can get inside, be exposed to the immune system. So what really fixed my gut was like literally 30 to 50 different types of fruits and vegetables a week. And then digestive enzymes. And then occasionally I'll do like I did a 2-week cleanse of oregano oil and berberine. SIBO is rampant. Everybody's got it these days. You can really herbals, but you got to have a good functional doctor to help you because a lot of people have motility issues too. So it's not just about fixing the overgrowth of bacteria. It's also why am I not moving my bowels? Did I have an infection? Have a poor diet? Am I stressed all the time? That could be part of it. So I think that gut health is the number one thing I start with every client. Functional medicine 101, naturopathic medicine 101.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think for me, my situation is probably a little bit different because I have really bad tree nut allergies and all of my children also have it. So I think it's probably more of a genetic thing.
That's pretty genetic, but you can also, there's peanut programs where people can get off of peanut allergies by just slowly introducing the allergens
for
over
peanuts,
time.
Yeah, for legumes, absolutely. I think our tree nut allergy it's across 3 different families and born with anaphylactic like allergy. So that's like some kind of genetic thing. But my problem is like everything is made in a nut processed facility, pretty much, and so it's so hard to tell. But after I had Skylar, my fourth, I started having really bad like gluten reactions, which that to me is something gut related, can be fixed. It's probably leaky gut.
A lot of people have developed gluten intolerance. It's actually because of all the glyphosate in the grains. And so like, you just got to be really, really vigilant about where you're getting any of the, if you notice.
So this is crazy. I was going to say, this is crazy because my husband, because I'm Italian, so like, I love pasta and everything. And my husband was doing research and he bought special pasta from Italy and from the EU, and it doesn't give me the same problem. And yep. I was like, I don't know.
Because the grain in America, I mean, part of it is the glyphosate, part of it is the genetics of the wheat here. But I'm full-blown celiac, but I tell people it's not necessarily everyone's celiac, because it's actually not everybody has autoimmunity. But if you do have autoimmunity, you really shouldn't be eating wheat, because it is very allergenic, especially American wheat. But I tell everybody, go to Europe, see what happens when you eat stuff there. For me, it's not even worth trying. Because if I go to Europe and I eat wheat and I have a whole week of being sick, it's not
like
worth
I spent all
me.
This money.
But if you think But if you think that you're not gluten intolerant, or you're not celiac, but you might be gluten intolerant, then see what happens when you go to Europe and order some flour from Europe and see how you feel.
Spending most of our lives indoors, it's startling to learn that the air inside our home can be up to 5 times more polluted than the air outside, and in extreme cases, even 100 times. With the latest consensus showing that a vast majority of us are living in areas plagued with poor air quality, it's becoming increasingly crucial to consider the quality of the air we breathe indoors. And I know this from firsthand. My family and I, especially during this season, struggle significantly with pollen. It's been particularly bad since we moved here, and allergies have been a constant battle. However, the start of the spring has been very different, and I attribute that change to our new ally, Air Doctor. This air purifier, celebrated by outlets like CNN and ABC, employs an ultra HEPA filter to trap 99.99% of harmful particles, including those pesky pollen and dust mites. The Air Doctor 3000 model has been a revelation in our home. Capable of purifying the air in spaces up to 630 square feet 4 times every hour, and it does it so quietly. I must admit, I was a skeptic at first, but the difference in air quality and our allergy symptoms has been undeniable. For anyone else tired of fighting through allergy season or concerned about their indoor air quality, I've got a special for you. Air Doctor offers a 30-day trial risk-free. If it doesn't make a significant difference in your home, you can return it, no questions asked, minus the shipping costs. So are you interested in giving it a shot? Head over to airdoctorpro.com. Use my promo code BBB to save up to 40% off, or up to $300 off depending on the model you choose. That's airdoctorpro.com. And don't forget to use my promo code BBB. Your lungs, and in my case, your spring season, will surely feel the difference. I really want to spend some time about the science of love. I think this is just so fascinating.
Sure.
One real quick, how did you get into it? And then, I don't know, just pour all the information in on me that I need to know.
Well, I got into the science of love because of that course I taught at Stanford. And I just woke up to like, oh my God, I saw this big presentation, this TED talk this woman gave. And she goes, the secret to longevity might be your relationships. And so as a doctor that's emphasizing health span and longevity, I'm like, why are we spending all this money on small molecules development? Why is this Brian Johnson trying to promote all this nonsense that like nobody can afford? What can people actually afford? What should people actually be putting their time and resources into? And I've always wondered, you know, why am I so drawn to people? You know, like why do I find it that if I can have friends and community, I feel so good. Like, why does that feel so good in my body? And why is it that when I feel alone or isolated, I mean, during the pandemic, I learned so much, right? Like, I think we all did. we all learned like what isolation does to us is it's very poisonous. And we saw a global experiment of human isolation. And we saw, oh my God, so many people developed eating disorders, relational problems, right? There's been this wave of mental illnesses. Young women are struggling more than ever with all sorts of cutting. Young men are confused about how to interact. Like, it was just so many downstream consequences to isolation. And I was like, why? Yeah, animal studies. And I was like, wait, we use animal isolation to induce mental illness. And if you actually take a rat and you socially isolate it and you give it drugs, it will turn to the drugs. But if you give it a community, it'll occasionally touch the drugs. It'll barely go near it. And I was like, okay, so clearly we need to look at this research and actually recognize that we just ran a really bad experiment on humanity, thinking that we were going to save lives. And a lot of people have died because of this. And I just felt like, how could we have gotten things so wrong and bought into this nonsense that like isolating people was going to save people? Like, no, the biggest mistake we did was telling people that they should isolate. We should have told people that they should have a pod of 20 people that they know and trust and spend time with. Instead, we said, isolate, isolate, isolate. And I think we're seeing now just how bad of a decision this was. So that was another big reason. I was teaching at Stanford online in 2020. And I remember being so socially isolated in Florida and being like, am I losing my mind right now? And my students were having breakdowns. And I was just like, I am not designed for isolation. Now, I had a lot of friends that were introverts and they did seem to fare better. But I would say in general, most people did not do well by themselves that were. And I found this to be this was like a big driver. So 2021 was when I started my company. And I was just like, I am convinced that love is linked to longevity. I need to know why. And I want to figure this out. And I want to build products around this. And so I met this woman, Sue Carter. She taught me about the neurobiology of oxytocin and vasopressin. And then that really taught me about masculine and feminine dynamics and why men are really designed for safety, for protection, for aggression, and to really like be the ones to go out and defend the tribe. Women are designed for building these trusted networks, right? These networks of human connection. And I think it's really important to recognize that everybody has vasopressin and everybody has oxytocin, but these are more dominant in men and women. And it's kind of designed to, we have these biological differences in order to keep the tribe alive. So I was very driven towards community building in the last 2 years, and pretty much everywhere I go, I build community. But I think women are particularly designed for this. And because we have had this very empowering last 50 years where women can now vote, we can not just vote, but we can get credit cards, we can do all sorts of things we couldn't do 2 years ago. We also have a world where women are working and are fairly isolated in maternity. And we have kind of seen communities fall apart a little bit because women are so busy doing so many roles. And I think we need to like not disempower women, not say don't work, but we actually do need to empower women to do what they do best, which is build connections and build networks and build communities, because this is actually what's going to help our society flourish, is recognizing we all need community, we all need connections, and women are built for this. But men are obviously able to do this, but the number of people who don't have friends is astonishing. Like, I think if you actually just Google, there's like a bunch of research. Yeah. 1 in 7 men have no friends.
That's crazy. Like you get a flat tire, you have no one to call, you know,
but 36% of women say they have 5 or more close friends, and like 1 in 10 Americans have no close friends. So like, this is a emergency. Like, without close connections, you will not thrive, period. And so I go into a new town, I'm in a new city, I made 20 friends within a month, maybe 30, maybe 40. And I am a super connector. So I am literally like, I'm definitely neurotypical. I'm on all sorts of spectrums, I'm sure, probably ADHD or mildly autistic. But I've basically learned to overcome that by being completely fearless socially, because I realize that everyone is awkward. Everyone's kind of awkward.
So true. So
if you just recognize that everyone's pretty much weird and awkward and nobody's normal, so why not just be fearlessly social? You know, like, what do you have to lose? And I've just learned that like having zero shame making friends is like, I mean, certainly it helps that I'm like friendly and I'm attractive, but like, even I just find that like, if you put a good energy out into the world, it will come back to you. It doesn't matter what you look like. It's all about how you present yourself to the world. So like I walk down the street around here, random strangers, men and women, just come talk to me. And I'm like always amazed by it. And they're just like, I have like a, if you present yourself as someone who's got a familiar energy, that's not right, afraid of right. others, then people just be your friend. But if you walk outside it and you have like social anxiety, you'll find that people won't be like afraid to talk to you. Right. So what I learned is that I can overcome some of my own social deficits by just recognizing that most people have them. And then just acknowledging that, yeah, I'm kind of weird and awkward. And so what? Like, I'm also like really brilliant and that's okay. And like, I'm not a normal person. I guess there's no normal, but kind of self-acceptance helps a lot, but also just recognizing like, I need friends to thrive and survive. That's it, period. Like there's no way around it. You can't just be alone in this world. So, you know, that's one strategy of doing it. But, you know, it's also that you have to look at human relationships, right? So like when someone gets into a new relationship, they often get into like a love bubble and then they get into like a family and then they're isolated because there's so much responsibility. And when I was growing up in my family, we had lots of family friends and lots of families around us. And it was like a tribe of people. That is kind of largely not always been the case. It's like not always the case anymore. So if you're in a family, your job is to create a community around your children because it's not just your job to raise these kids. It's the community's job. And I think we just don't see ourselves as tribal people anymore, but we really are. And it's what's best for us is to like have input, have like share childcare, have kids have sleepovers, have parents have nights off. Like my parents regularly took vacations without us. And we had 4 or 5 kids in the family, so we could all take care of each other a little bit more. But I do think that we've got to look at the way we're letting society devolve. And it's no surprise that a lot of people are struggling in their primary relationships because so much pressure is on two parents to be the leaders of a family. And it's like so much work for two parents to be in charge of everything. Like it really shouldn't just be their job. It should be the grandparents' job. And there's actually this thing called the grandmother effect, which is that a grandmother in a family is more likely to live a longer, healthier life. And the family is more likely to have healthier kids if there's an elder present. So it's actually really important. And I see this is a massive luxury for a lot of families, but I think it's an important way to keep a family connected and together is to have the grandparents involved. And that hasn't always been the case in my family. And it's kind of sad because I think that I missed out a little bit on grandparents. I had 2 that were pretty involved. Well, 1 that was pretty involved, but 3 weren't. And I see families that have grandparents actively, like one of my sisters is a world-class artist and her husband's a teacher and she works all day, but her husband's mother takes care of the kids when they're done with school. And it's just such a massive luxury that she's able to like work and be a working woman and have this support system. So it's the kids are so well-adjusted, they're so happy. And I just think without that kind of support, it's really hard for parents to do it all. You know, most parents are like trying to work more than one job and then raise the kids and feed themselves. And it's hard.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very different than how it was even 50 years ago. It's very different. And also like a lot of grandparents, like I think of my mom and she's 69 and she's still working. And now she works because she wants to work, not because she has to, but she wants it, wants to. And I'm just thinking of how that has even changed where there's some women or men her age that work at this age because they have to or they need to, which is it's very different.
I do think that there's nothing wrong with working into your role. I mean, I don't ever plan to retire, but I think the key is like, are you connected, you know? But I do want to touch on Adamo and talk a little bit about like sexuality a bit because my company Adamo is creating the first sex therapy since Masters and Johnson. And right now, sexuality and even talking about sex in most families, in most parents, most couples is really tough. And people don't know where to go to like actually discuss their issues. And so there's like less than 2,000 sex therapists in our country. And I thought to myself, if I'm going to tackle love, then like what better way to do that than looking at building a method that can actually affect ideally sexuality, sexual function, dysfunction, sexual communication, emotional closeness, passion, intimacy, and commitment. And then we've been testing this method on even attachment. So all of these facets we've been actually doing a clinical study around. And I can't reveal the results yet because we're doing the analysis right now. But according to our researchers, we actually have found some statistically significant results in these endpoints. And the main intention here is like, okay, so adults never got sex ed. Most people are learning their sexual schemas from pornography. And there was even an article today in the New York Times about young people getting brain damage from asphyxiation and choking during sex. And where do you think they're learning that? They're learning that through porn. And we're like devolving sexually as a culture. Like people are learning about sex through porn, and porn is becoming highly animalistic and sometimes fairly violent. And the emphasis on female pleasure and female sexuality is really absent from pornography. So then there's the question of what do we do about it? Well, we wanted to design a sex therapy that actually addresses sex, because currently, if you actually look at sex education, you are like, most of it doesn't actually address the sexual act. It's all about the psychology around sex. So we discovered that by talking to lots of people, that most people's problems are not just what happens before sex, but during sex. So, you know, there's problems with pain, problems with arousal, problems with erection, problems with orgasm, and they're all interconnected. And so what we did was we pioneered an approach to teaching the science of sexual pleasure. And I'm just like overjoyed because I feel like we're making history right now. And it's just so exciting. We ran our first cohort. And honestly, we were building this product. We were launching the study. We were launching the product. We were editing the videos down to the finish line. We ran it. We had a program for 100 people. We learned so much from these couples, and we're running our next cohort in June. So if people are interested in learning how to optimize their intimacy with their partner, then go to livingadamo.com or at livingadamo on Instagram, and you can learn more about what we're doing. But it's pretty exciting. And I think that if everybody was having better sex, they'd have a better quality of life. And there's a lot of evidence that a great sex life is hugely correlated with longevity.
I love that. I think that anybody can benefit from that. Like I have a partner and we're very intimate. We very much love each other. But I mean, still, you're still learning that with your partner, and you're learning it in different facets of the life. It's like, okay, it's like that first honeymoon phase. And then it's like, now you're having a baby, and yeah, now you have four kids, and you're both really thriving in your career. Yeah. You have to, it changes, and you're all, it's like every single phase that we're in.